Welcome back, and we'll continue on with our conversation with rock and roll investigator R. Gary Patterson, and a close friend to John Lennon and the rest of the Beatles, and of course the creator of Mercy Beat magazine, author, PR man, Bill Haley, in just a few moments. And we've been talking about the life, the times, and the death of John Lennon. And then, of course, there is, 34 years after his death, the Lennon legacy. And a whole question as to whether Yoko Ono has done justice to that legacy. A couple of months ago, Ono entered into a contract for global branding, licensing, and rights management with Epic Rights as the global licensing agent to develop a global branding and licensing initiative for the music of John Lennon, but not just his music, also some of his rare archival sketches. Now, keep in mind that Yoko Ono has essentially sold just about everything to do with Lennon's likeness. I believe she's sold the rights for Lennon's image to be used on everything from sunscreen. I believe there's even a watch featuring Lennon's backside on it. A couple of years ago, I think it was 2009, she caused quite an uproar at a Lennon exhibit, which featured his blood-stained clothes. Now, she claims that she was trying to draw attention to gun violence, but many of Lennon's fans, of course, and his family members felt that, that was going beyond the pale. We'll perhaps touch on this aspect of the Lennon legacy as well when my conversation with Bill Haley and, or Bill Harry, rather, and Gary Patterson continues here on Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back to Coast AM. Bill Harry on the line from England and R. Gary Patterson, a rock and roll investigator, as we continue to delve into the life and death of John Lennon. I'll get both of you to weigh in on this. How would you characterize Yoko Ono's handling of Lennon's legacy?
Myself, personally, I found it completely sort of restricts sort of the truth about John. It restricts all exciting documentaries can be made. You know, the actual control, this is complete control of someone whose legacy really belongs to the world, someone who the world loved and respected. And but, you know, it's so controlled. I've had lots of companies come on to me saying they'd wanted to do documentaries about John, and have great things to say and great interviews and things, but they can't do it because Yoko wants control of all this. And, of course, it reminds me of the fact that when John lived in the Dakota, no one could get hold of John except via Yoko. And this is the same. This is complete control of someone who I always reckon belonged to the world.
Gary, how do you think John Lennon would react seeing his face on coffee cups, sunscreen, his songs being used in Nike ads, and I believe Real Love was recently used in a Target commercial?
Well, you know, I think there's a little irony there, because when the Beatles first came over to the United States, their likenesses were on everything. Lunchboxes, combs, brushes, whatever. And they were never paid a cent for it, because one of Brian's, I guess, mistakes was he didn't take care of the licensing. So they say they lost millions of dollars on it. Sadly, and I agree with Bill and everything he says, but sadly, I think that in the United States, it's all about, well, creating a fortune. I mean, if you went to licensing today, James Dean, Elvis Presley, and Marilyn Monroe, from what I've read, and it probably still is, that they're the largest amount of money generated to them after they're dead. So their estates draw in millions. I think it's kind of cold, myself, you know, by putting someone's pictures on coffee cups and you know, sort of degrades the impact of a life. Of course, all fans, you know, they know John, they know his music, and they're still led to it. But I remember also that the Beatles never really wanted their music used in commercials. I think it was George Harrison who said that he didn't want something used for a sausage commercial, you know, along those lines. And of course, when Michael Jackson acquired some of the publishing, the first thing he did was he went out and licensed a song for Nike, I think maybe It's Come Together. And Paul McCartney was furious, but Yoko was all for it. So, you know, that was at that time. So, you know, I guess it's a double-edged sword. And it's sad to say that greed and everything else would try to tarnish the legacy of someone as great as John Lennon.
All right, let's go to the phones. On the wild card line, Mark is in Oregon. Mark, welcome. Good morning.
Yes, good evening, gentlemen. I really want to thank y'all for such an interesting show. I think sometimes the category of real-life biographies and autobiographies in particular here tonight really grabbed the interest of people when you, as you have so well done tonight, broken down some very interesting lives that reflect so much about the times around them and just people who really influenced the world in some very significant ways, and I do appreciate it. I have something I wanted to mention because it's a piece of personal information that came to me in 1982 by someone who you would probably very, very much suspect as being a legitimate source and not having a story to tell that they've made up. Very serious person. And it was 1982, several years after John Lennon was assassinated, so there was some time for this to get around, and that's when I heard it in 1982, and it was that Yoko Ono had an acting school in New York City that was ongoing at the time of Lennon's death, or at least in the recent, very recent past, was actually operating, and that Mark David Chapman was a student there, and that this was a method acting that she was teaching, but also a very unconventional method, and that this method actually had the ability to program and hypnotize a person. So that Yoko Ono, according to this individual whom I spoke with in 1982, down in Savannah, actually Tybee, Georgia, Savannah, Georgia, is where this information came to me, and that he had been programmed at Yoko Ono's acting school, I think we could assume probably by Yoko Ono if this occurred.
Well, let me just stop you there because we have to be pretty careful about tossing around an allegation like that with an unnamed source, and I've never heard anything like that.
Well, I was wondering, Richard, if either of the gentlemen had ever heard that. That's what I was also curious about.
I haven't heard anything about.
No, I know that she was involved in New York in this in Fluxus, this creative group who, and she did performances with them, and she was quite close, and she was involved with them for years, but that is basically performance art and everything. I don't think she had her own school. She was just a member of it.
All right. Thanks nonetheless, Mark, and appreciate the call. Let's say hi to Jimmy in Fairmont, West Virginia, also on the wild card line. Good morning, Jimmy.
Good morning, and thank you so much for, again, a wonderful show, and thank you so much for the books you've written. I mean, you've definitely brought a lot of good information to those of us all over the world who love John. And I have an interesting question. I hope it's interesting. Did John Lennon know Jerry Garcia, and did he have any opinion of the Grateful Dead? I mean, I never got to see John Lennon, but I chased the Dead all over the planet, and I saw him over 600 times. And actually, Robert Hunter's got one of my sculptures sitting next to his computer. But did John Lennon know Jerry? Did he have an opinion of Jerry? And by the way, yesterday, the 9th, was his 19th anniversary, because I loved it. You played some Dead music earlier.
Oh, that's right. Jerry Garcia died in 95. That's a great question. I mean, the Beatles stopped touring in 66. Would they have any occasion to have crossed paths, Gary or Bill?
I'm not sure that they ever crossed paths with Jerry Garcia and the Grateful Dead. I know that, you know, John had many projects, and Bill would be the one to answer that. Bill, what do you think?
No, I don't know of any sort of time he's talked about the sort of Grateful Dead. He's talked about the influence of over the years of many artists. You know, he liked all kinds of sort of music, and lots of people who influenced him. And a lot of his songs, he didn't actually, you know, part of it he copied from other places. And many of his quotes that he's quoted for, he didn't actually originate the quotes, but they're all attributed to him and things. And but I know his influence, like when he went to, I think it was Bermuda, and he heard the B-52s, he was quite impressed by those. They inspired him. And over the period of his life, he was so involved in music that, of course, he would have heard the Grateful Dead and played their music, because he would play music all the time. This was his life.
All right, Jimmy, thanks for the call. There's been so much sort of speculation about the state of the relationship between McCartney and Lennon towards the end of Lennon's life, and much of what we hear comes from Paul McCartney, who, let's face it, at times, you know, tends to sort of, he's been accused of a little bit of revisionism, but, you know, it's his story. He's entitled to tell it, certainly. But what is your take on where things stood with Lennon and McCartney? McCartney insists, you know, everything was great. They had patched everything up. We've heard sort of the counter argument to that, that things weren't so good. What's your understanding?
Well, basically, they were a great team. And this is a team that created great things together. And you know, mate, I'm talking about the songs rather than the four-man Beatles. But the two of them as songwriters. And in fact, when they were kids, and they were sort of writing together at Paul's house in Portland Road, they'd given up. They weren't playing any longer. They'd given up the Quarrymen, and they just wanted to be songwriters. And Paul had the ambition of writing for Frank Sinatra. And he actually wrote, at the time when he was a kid, this song which he wanted Sinatra to record, called Suicide. And in fact, many, many years later, when Lennon McCartney were established, Sinatra contacted them asking if they had an original song for him. And Paul sent him Suicide. And Sinatra said, "Who is this guy? Well, is he trying to take the mickey out of me, you know?" But they were doing these songs. And what they made a vow in the late 50s, they made a vow that whoever wrote the most part of a song would have his name first. So it would be McCartney-Lennon or Lennon-McCartney. And if you notice on the first two singles, one is McCartney-Lennon and the other single is Lennon-McCartney. Now, it was decided at the time we have to sort of get straightened out so that a deal that all the songs would have the one thing instead of changing all the time. So there was an arrangement to have a meeting with Brian Epstein to make the decision. And so when Paul turned up at the meeting, he found that John had arrived earlier and talked Brian Epstein into ensuring that all the songs from now on, whoever wrote them, would be Lennon and McCartney. It would be... Lennon McCartney. And in fact, so this went on with all the songs, and the fact John really benefited, because it was Paul who was writing the majority of songs for other people. You know, everyone from PJ Proby, Peter and Gordon, you know, so many people Paul wrote songs for, and they were all under the name Lennon McCartney, for which John and later on Yoko would get quite substantial royalties. And then later on, it was John who actually broke that pact. And he put his numbers under the Plastic Ono Band instead of Lennon McCartney, you know, so he broke this sort of deal. And the thing is, with Yesterday, the song had nothing really to do with the Beatles. Paul composed the song, wrote it, he went into the studios, recorded himself. None of the Beatles were involved in the writing or recording that number. And then many years later, in fact, you know, I think it was 5 or 6 years ago, you know, Paul thought, you know, with Yesterday, this is a particular song of mine and everything. And he just wondered and asked permission from Yoko if for Yesterday could he possibly have that it's under McCartney-Lennon, which he refused. Now, I thought it was a perfectly reasonable request in the circumstances.
Certainly.
Although the press seemed a bit hostile to Paul because he requested it. But with Yesterday, when Michael Jackson bought over the Beatles songs, so he got a share of the royalties for Yesterday. And of course, after John's death, Yoko did. And because of a change in law in America favoring widows, with the royalties for Yesterday, Paul got about 15%. And Yoko got about 60%.
Oh, my.
So Yoko makes far, far more money out of Yesterday, a song completely created and run by Paul. And he gets a small percentage of that song.
We've just got
so
about
a couple... understand why,
sure.
At least at one time, wanted to have at least his name in front of the credit for it.
We just have a couple minutes here before the break, but let me ask you then, did that remain a sore point between the two up until Lennon's death?
No, because Paul, in particular, is particularly forgiving. Remember, if Paul made a decision, that's Paul's decision. If Paul wanted to do something, that's Paul wanting to do it. On the other hand, with John, he couldn't make a decision without Yoko. Yoko more or less dictated what relationships John would have. And I think that Yoko presented a lot of barriers between John and Paul, who probably might have got together once again to write songs. And, you know, it wasn't John's decision itself, and I think it was probably had a lot of snide remarks made about Paul over the years he lived in the Dakota. But Paul is forgiving. Paul would have... like to get back, and he wanted to get back with John, actually.
Do you think that was in the cards, had Lennon lived?
Oh, yes, I'm pretty sure, because had Lennon lived, from what I've been told of friends of mine who actually talked to John, he was going to go back touring by himself, you know, what I mean as the main artist, and he was going to come back to Britain to tour and do things, and he seemed to be very excited about the future.
What are your thoughts on that matter, Gary? Do you think that that Lennon and McCartney would have teamed up again?
I think it had been inevitable. I think that they would. I mean, they had that period apart, and there was a lot of anger, a lot of frustration. And, you know, it seems like at the end, I know that in certain books, McCartney would come to the Dakota with his guitar, and John would say, hey, this isn't like Liverpool. You have to call me and you just don't come over like you used to, which sounded pretty cool and cold. I know that when I talked to Carl Perkins before he passed away, I spent a whole weekend at a convention with him, and he told me fascinating stories about working on a tug-of-war album with McCartney. And, of course, Paul owns his publishing now. But he came up with a song called My Old Friend, and he played it, we played it for Paul when he went to the chorus. The chorus was, hey, my old friend, think about me every now and then. And he said that when he played it, that Paul looked stunned, and tears were in his eyes. And he said, wait just a minute. And he went and he brings Linda, he says, play it for me. And he said, as he played the song, every time he got to the chorus, that Paul would look at Linda. And he was so emotionally moved that he got up and walked away. And Linda comes up to Carl, and she says, Carl, how did you know? And he says, well, what do you mean? I didn't mean to upset you. What do you mean? How did I know? And she said, the last time that Paul saw John at the Dakota, as John was walking into the door, he turned over his shoulder, and he looked at Paul and said, hey, old friend, think about me every now and then. And he was convinced that John was reaching out to him, to Paul, to sort of settle it. So who knows?
All right. We'll continue on the other side. Gary Patterson, Bill Harry, talking about the life and times of John Lennon here on Coast to Coast AM. And we'll get back to our conversation with rock and roll investigator R. Gary Patterson and his wonderful surprise guest, Bill Harry, of course, an intimate friend of all four Beatles, as we continue to explore the life and times of John Lennon. couple of interesting things that you may not have known about John Lennon. He didn't like the sound of his own voice. According to George Martin and biographer Ray Coleman, John was never satisfied with the way he sounded on vinyl. And Martin said that Lennon had an intense dislike of his own voice and was forever asking for more effects to be added to alter his vocals. And another interesting thing was that John was a meat lover. Of course, the Beatles were trendsetters in more than just music. As part of their forward-looking philosophies, George and Ringo turned to vegetarianism. Paul became such a vegetarian enthusiast that he would later market a line of vegetarian frozen dinners. And by the end of the Beatles era, John was the only meat eater in the group. Back with more on John Lennon, his life, his times, and his untimely death when Coast to Coast continues here. Stay with us. And we are back on Coast to Coast AM. Richard Serrett, along with rock and roll investigator R. Gary Patterson and Bill Harry, of course, the founder of Mercy Beat magazine. Bill, Merseyside, what region of England is that?
It's in the northwest of England, yeah. Incidentally, I heard you sort of mention when it was talking about the program that people were interested in conspiracy theories. I'm just wondering whether they'd heard the theory about John Lennon's death in the connection with Michael X.
Michael X?
Yes.
I'm not familiar with that, no.
Well, it's a theory that... John's death was part of this conspiracy, which began with his friendship with Michael X. You know, I've thoroughly researched it, and it's quite an interesting conspiracy theory anyway.
Oh, are you familiar with that, Gary?
No, I'd like to hear it.
Yeah, let's delve into that a little bit.
Yes, well, Michael X, who called himself, was Michael Abdul Malik, and he was a one-time pimp. He was a strong-arm rent collector as well. And John and Yoko met him in 1969 when he began a community centre for black culture called the Black House in North London. In February 1970, after they cut their hair short, John and Yoko arranged a press call at the Black House and gave Michael X their hair. In exchange, he gave him a pair of bloodstained boxing trunks previously worn by Muhammad Ali. They could auction, you know, in aid of their peace campaign. And then the Black House was mysteriously burned down. Malik was arrested for demanding money with menaces, and he'd already been in jail. So John and Yoko provided his bail money, but Malik jumped that, and he left the country, moved to Trinidad. John and Yoko visited him in Port of Spain, then he arranged for Apple to pay him £10,000 in advance for a book, which he never wrote. And Malik began another commune, which he also called the Black House, with some of the same faces of the first that burnt in a mysterious fire. And the police investigating the arson discovered two bodies buried in a shallow grave. One was Joseph Skerritt, the other was a white woman, Gail Ann Benson. Malik was convicted of plotting a murder and was sentenced to hang. John paid for his lawyers to fly to Trinidad to defend him. He also wrote to the authorities to plead for Malik's life. He wrote a statement sent to all the politicians, friends and everyone saying, we urge you to do what you can for this human being. He did everything he can to get behind Michael X, but Michael X was hanged in May 1975. And then the conspiracy theory began because Gail Ann Benson met a film director, Hakim Jamal, an American activist at the Black House. They became lovers, and they travelled to France together, and it's believed they were in a menage a trois with actress Jean Seberg. They then travelled to Trinidad, got to know Michael X, and when Jamal left her behind when he went on a trip to America, Benson and X became lovers. And after the fire, a body in that skerritt was found. She'd been knifed and buried alive. 6 months later, Jamal was found murdered in his hometown in Boston. And then Jean Seberg's decomposed body was found wrapped in a blanket in the back of a car in Paris. And the following year, John Lennon was murdered. Now, it was alleged that Jamal, Seberg and Lennon had been murdered as revenge for the killing of Benson, who had a powerful family background. The father was said to be Captain Leonard Plug, a former Tory MP, died in California 1981. But interestingly enough, it was revealed only in the late 80s that the real father of Gail was Jack Bouvier, making Gail the half-sister of Jackie Kennedy.
Oh, my.
And then Seberg, who was an American actress, came to fame in St. Joan. But she then went to live in sort of France and married the author Romain Gary. But during her trip to America, she was associated with members of the Black Panther movement. The FBI sought to discredit her and spread the rumor that the child she was expecting was the result of an affair with a Black Panther member. This caused her such anxiety that the baby died at birth. It was white. She had the body sent to her hometown to be exhibited in a glass coffin so that everyone could see its true color. Then she, her body was found in a Renault. You know, I mean, so that was a conspiracy theory regarding this Michael X character.
So that's fascinating, but how Mark David Chapman would become involved in that?
That's why I don't think the conspiracy theory was right, because there was a connection between all the others. But, you know, and of course the thing is that John had gone so much behind and paid money and done everything he could for this Michael X, so that with the revenge of the murders that Michael X did, you know, it was assumed that all these murders happening was not just a coincidence. That was the conspiracy. But where John's murderer comes in, it's obviously a coincidence, you know?
Yeah, it seems to break down there. It's a fascinating tale nonetheless.
Yeah.
Let's go back to the phones. And this time on the wild card line, we have Helena from Los Angeles. Good morning, Helena.
Yes, hi. It's Helena.
Apologies.
Okay,
Helena.
I think I heard mention of John Green, who was the tarot reader for the Lennons. Yoko hired him and then introduced him to John as the oracle. And And John Green wrote a book called The Dakota Days about his experiences. I actually met John Green in Los Angeles in the early 90s, about 1990, 91. And he was reading cards then. A friend of mine had met him at a party where he'd read, his cards had been read by him. And I got, and told me, oh, this guy used to read for the Lennons. And I had no idea that he was actually hired by the Lennons for 5.5 years. I only found this out after I read the book. And speaking about Mark Chapman, he was up for parole, and I read what he said at the parole. It seemed like his motive for killing John Lennon was that he wanted to really take out someone who was extremely popular and well-known, so he could kind of hitch on to that popularity. It was ego-motivated. That's what I got from reading the testimony. And about the same time, I thought, I really want to find my tarot reader. You know, John Green, he was so fantastic. And I did some discovery work on the internet, and I found out that John Green is unfortunately no longer alive. I connected with his widow, and we had an email correspondence for a while. And then another thing I wanted to say is that in John Green's book, he points out how Yoko sent him off to meet a sorcerer, and she was always trying to manipulate John. And I asked John when I actually had a reading with him, why didn't you warn John Lennon that his life was in danger? And he told me that John was always getting death threats. And then after reading The Dakota Days, I found out that about 4 months prior to John's death, when he started producing all that music and everything, Yoko felt that she'd gotten into her own power, and she had someone else she was working with. And so she no longer used John Green's services. he was literally put up in an extra apartment that they had in New York, and all his expenses were taken care of for 5.5 years. But it was just kind of like he was on the outs with Yoko, and John actually really liked him a lot. And I guess the last time that John Green saw Lennon, he just said, you know, I'm sorry, it's like this, but, you know, the missus, whatever, she has her own thoughts. Anyway, I was just wondering if you were that acquainted with John Green, the Tarot reader.
In fact, well, Yoko employed other tarot card readers, such as Mike Tree, and he wrote a book, John Lennon Barefoot in Utopia. Now, he seemed to say that John Green also used the name Charlie Swan, and Tree wrote, the card reader came into Yoko's life in 1973 when John departed for Los Angeles, leaving her alone in the sprawling apartment. She had initially hired Swan to pair to the apartment of a ghost she believed to be the spirit of actor Robert Ryan's wife, Jessie, who had died there. When John returned from his last weekend in Los Angeles, Swan began reading for him too, and John referred to him as the Oracle. And he says that his curiosity about numbers intensified when Yoko showed him Chiro's Book of Numbers. So, you know, basically had other tarot card readers, and, you know, sort of Yoko had him very, very involved in all this at the particular time. And I've read the books by all of them, and they give a particular insight into John's life in the Dakota. But the best book I've read about John in the Dakota and his relationship with Yoko and all what happened during those years is the one written by Frederick Seaman, who was John's assistant in the Dakota. It's a fascinating book, but it gives a real insight into what life was really like for John in those days.
Thank you for the call, Helena. Are you still on friendly terms with Paul McCartney and Ringo Starr?
Well, yes, it's never sort of been other than that. But I've never bothered contacting them because I get the feeling somehow that everybody I knew who sort of tries to contact them is after something off them. I mean, I did when I contacted Paul about a project I was involved in, he fully endorsed me, wrote to me, fully endorsed me, and things like that. But you know, they move in completely different circles. I mean, I used to meet Paul when he used to have all his lunchtime things for Buddy Holly each year, being invited along to things like that. But, I mean, these days, I mean, I've had contacts if I want to get in touch with them. But I think I can't get in touch, really, because they think, oh, people are asking me all the time, can you get hold of Paul McCartney and do this for me? Can you get hold of Paul McCartney and ask to do this? Can you get hold of Ringo Starr? And I get a feeling that contacting is like as if I'm going to ask them for a favour or something. But, I mean, if I wanted to contact them, I could. But, as I said, they move in completely different circles now than when we used to be friends for many, many years.
Gary, did you want to jump in with another question for Bill?
No, actually, this has been fascinating. I've enjoyed listening to everything, so this is good. And I was with I did a convention up in Cleveland, Ohio, and Cynthia Lennon was there. And Ringo Starr was playing the same night with his all-star band, and someone in the audience asked her, are you going to go see Ringo and spend some time with him tonight? And she said, no. She said, they don't think about me, and I don't think about them. So it was sort of sad, you know, a little sadness there. Of course, you know, Cynthia has had a couple books on the subject too, hasn't she, Bill?
Yes. But it's like with the thing of sort of Ringo. I mean, Ringo was very close to Rory Storm and the Hurricanes. That was the main, and they were really very, very close sort of people. And when Rory died, and people said about Ringo, or was he going to go to the funeral? And he said, no, why should I go to the funeral? I wasn't there at his birth either.
Interesting take on things, I suppose. Listen, we just got a couple of minutes left here. Gary, just bring us up to date. What are you working on these days, and what can we look forward to?
Well, actually, you know, I've got a few things going. I'm going to be on tour with Peggy Sue Guerin, who Buddy Holly wrote the song for, Peggy Sue. She's putting a show together. It's going to be touring, and it's going to be starting out west. And hopefully I can see some people who would like to come say hello. I know that we have Steve Taylor and his wife, Heather, from England, who's coming over. He does an excellent Buddy Holly. Matter of fact, he actually won an award from Paul McCartney. Also, I'm working with a publisher called August Words, and it's a fascinating idea of getting books directly into the marketplace where the author makes much more money. And I know Bill would be interested in that as I am. So I'm going to do a series of books or work on a series of books. So if you have, I want to concentrate on rock and roll. So if you do have a book in rock and roll that you'd like to have published, you know, you can contact me on my website or go to August Words. We're going to do a whole series of these. So that's going to give me something to do, Richard. And yes, Kim, I hear that you're listening. I love you too. And I hope to see everybody when we get out there. So this is good. I'm happy.
All right. And in the meantime, we have the website, rgarypatterson.com. And any chance there'll be a sequel to Take a Walk on the Dark Side?
Well, actually, I'm working on that as we speak, and I've been working on it, but it seems like last year was not the best year for me because I was in a hospital and had surgery, and I thought, oh, my gosh, that sort of delayed me. But we will have another sequel to that. That'll be coming out. Hopefully, I can finish it by winter. And, of course, you got to go through the placement and all that. But, like I said, I have a publisher who's very interested and wants me as an editor and wants to do a whole series of rock books, and I'm happy about that. So it could be on that, and we'll be putting it out, and, Richard, we'll be doing a show.
Absolutely. Looking forward to it. And Bill, you've written so many books, many of the major encyclopedic works. What are you working on these days?
Well, I've got five books I'm working on, but the major one is a big two-volume Beatles encyclopedia. The first one I had out in 92, the Ultimate Beatles Encyclopedia, I revised in 2002 as just the Beatles Encyclopedia, but ever since, week after week, month after month, I've been researching and researching and have literally millions of words. So the new encyclopedia has to be a two-volume work. You know, the first one was well over 1,018 pages, and they already had to cut out over 40,000 words because they couldn't fit it into one book.
Well, we'll look forward to that, Bill.
A two-volume Beatles encyclopedia with lots of stuff people have never heard of ever before.
Can't wait. Listen, Bill, Gary, a real pleasure. Thank you so much for this.
Yes, thank you, Richard.
Always fun, Richard.
And for George Norrie, Lisa Lyon, Stephanie Smith, Chris Burrows, Dan Galanti, Sean Latasur, Brian Opry, Gina Selvati, here in Toronto, Wes Atkinson, Scott Guest, and Gord Harris. And for all of you listening at home, thank you for your ears. I'm Richard Serrett.